I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. I'm constantly amazed by those journalists who have the job of covering President Donald J. Trump. Honestly, I don't know how they do it. Major Garrett covers that beat for CBS News, and today he pulls back the curtain for us on the challenges he's had reporting on a chief executive who was openly hostile to reporters. After following Trump from the campaign trail to the White House, Garrett shares his insights on the 45th president. Then, one of the most accomplished musicians with some of the least recognition outside the world of jazz, Vijay Iyer. I can't wait to introduce this amazing pianist, teacher, and award winner to you and get you up to date after this hour's news. There's barely an hour these days when President Trump isn't making news. Major Garrett has had a ringside seat to all the drama from his perch as CBS News' chief White House correspondent, a post he's held since 2012. Major has written a new book about what he's witnessed. It's titled, very aptly, Mr. Trump's Wild Ride, The Thrills, Chills, Screams, and Occasional Blackouts of an Extraordinary Presidency. Major Garrett is a University of Missouri journalism grad, and it's a pleasure to have him back on the show. Major, so good to have you here.
Steve, it's great to see you again. Thanks for having me.
I should point out, we taped this conversation on Thursday, and who knows what will happen between now and Tuesday when this is going to air, Major. That's the deal.
Who knows? All caps, italicized, underscore.
There you go. There you go. So what's life like as a White House correspondent these days? Just how crazy must that job be?
Well, it's more hectic than it ever has been before, and Donald Trump is the fourth president I've covered up close. I covered George Herbert Walker Bush's presidency from the vantage point of Congress, but I covered the last year of the Clinton presidency every day at the White House, the first 2.5 years of the George W. Bush presidency from the White House, the first 2 years and the back 2 years of the Obama presidency every day at the White House, and now every single day of the Trump presidency. And there is something about his approach to leadership, his approach to the presidency that does, and this is not a controversial assessment, not even in the Trump White House, approach, the mannerisms of the White House, the vocality, meaning the vocabulary and the way you use your words and the way you give orders, the way you assemble teams to carry out those orders, all of that is different in the Trump world. And it is so different that Washington is still, on a day-to-day basis, knocked off balance, jarred, left uncomfortable in some cases, depending on your political or ideological perspective, full of anxiety watching the Trump presidency carry forth. And the point I wanted to make in the book is that is not either abnormal or normal. It just is. And the is what matters. I don't have a crystal ball. People ask me all the time, is this the new normal in American politics? I don't know. What I do know is it is an experiment that goes on every single day. What is the experiment? What is one of the kernels of that experiment? Well, as you well know, Donald Trump represents something completely new for the American presidency. Every single occupant of that office until Donald Trump had one or two items on their resume. They'd either had at least mildly, and in many cases, long and distinguished career in elective politics, or they had led large armies into battle victoriously. Trump did neither of those things. As a matter of fact, he disdained both of them. And nevertheless is our 45th president. And as I write in the book, that tells us something new about what our level of expectations are for this office. And boy, has he brought new dimensions to the expectations we had collectively as a nation about what this office looks like, what it sounds like, and what are its, I won't even call them rhythms, what are the ups and downs of its daily approach. Well, and there are so many of them.
For you, I was going to say the daily in and out here, the yin and yang of this White House, how do you manage it as a reporter dealing with something when there's no rhythm, there's no sort of set way of going about business? News can break any moment.
Any moment, at any hour of any day. midnight on a Saturday is a perfectly good news breaking time for Donald Trump. It has been in the past. Every hour has within it the potential to have something that either is or looks like breaking news from President Trump. So you have to hire more people. You have to have more shifts. You just have to have more bodies available. I don't do this by myself, not by any stretch of the imagination. I have a whole team of producers, other correspondents, people who have to pitch in. Literally, you're woken up in the middle of the night to say, you've got to pitch in because this thing has happened, or we need to write a story about this particular tweet and some of the backstory. All of those things are going on in news organizations around Washington. One of the interesting things about this reality in Washington is newsrooms there are growing larger again after shrinking for many years. Across the country, not so much. I hope we can turn the corner on that and newsrooms around the country also begin to hire more people and get back to where they used to be. But you know and I know, I mean, I started in this industry in newspapers for 17 years in the newspaper business, and I've watched it be hollowed out across the country.
Right.
Newsrooms are rebuilding themselves in New York and Washington. I hope they begin to rebuild themselves in communities around the country because it's an important asset for every community to have. And journalism is now a live and heavily debated topic in our country. And I hope it leads to a revival and a reappreciation of what a community newspaper can and often does say to its community about the times in which it lives.
CBS News White House correspondent Major Garrett is my guest. Covering this White House has got to be exhausting, is it?
So there's a chapter in the book called 10 Days in May. It's about the 10 days in May of 2017, starting with the firing of James Comey, and all the things related to that action, plus many other events that, if no other event other than Comey, for example, had happened, that would have been plenty for 10 days. But how about the visit of two prominent Russian officials, one the foreign minister, the other the U.S. ambassador, the ambassador of the United States, in the Oval Office, yucking it up with Trump, with Pravda in there taking pictures and no U.S. journalist at all given access? And what did the president say? Was it highly classified? Was it sensitive? Was it about Israel? That all ran amok in the next 2 or 3 days. Then there was a North Korean ballistic missile test, a massive hack that was attributed to the North Koreans, at least initially. Then there were lots of other stupendous events. The president gave all sorts of different explanations, and the White House was tied in knots over why he fired Comey and what the underlying rationale was. Those explanations began to melt away and become contradicted. Then the president talks to NBC and says, well, Russia was on my mind. What? I mean, we were juggling all of these things on an hour-to-hour basis, and I'll make two observations about that chapter to answer your question directly. No fewer than three White House correspondents, having read my book and this chapter in particular, who covered all the same events that I did, came up to me recently and said, I forgot half that stuff.
Yeah.
They wrote
yes.
about it.
Yes.
They did the stories and forgot about half of it. Another reporter—
Because the churn is just so relentless. Yeah.
And another reporter came up to me and said, I have been trying to explain to my spouse, since the Trump presidency began, how difficult and how traumatic and how exhausting it is. And she never quite got it. Then I said, just read this chapter, 10 Days in May. He said to me, she read it and goes, I get it now.
Mm-hmm.
I understand. Yeah. Because it's the velocity, the intensity, the import. I mean, these are not all trivial stories. These are not little shiny objects, and especially in those 10 days in May. With Trump, there are some shiny objects that look important, but in the end really aren't. Those 10 days, everything was heavy. Massively heavy, and the lift to get underneath it, understand the story, report it out, do it accurately, try to keep some sense of context was among the most challenging set of days I can ever remember as a White House correspondent.
You know, Major, there's a theory out there about this president that there isn't another politician in the country and maybe the world who could go about business with the pace that this president does, with the level of controversy that this president does. Why does this work for him? Why can he get away with it? And lesser politicians would have been wiped off the map by what all these actions.
The best answer I can give for you is that he feeds off controversy in a way I've never seen a politician feed off of it. Most politicians either wilt in the face of controversy or begin to have some measure of self-doubt. There's controversy. The polls are moving. People are angry at me. Some of my allies have begun to criticize
me. But not this president.
Not this president. he definitely feeds off it. Even when his friends are screaming at him, "What are you doing? What's wrong with you?" He says, "I've got everyone's attention. I'm the center of this story." And there is something about this president's ego, which is large. Every American president has a large ego. That's just a fact. Don't kid yourself. You have to be a narcissist to run for this job, to believe you can do it, and to believe you can carry it out. It's not a negative. It's quite often a positive. It's usually the thing that makes them the president and not somebody else, that higher degree of narcissism. For this president, there's an ego component where he just loves to be the one who's churning the waters. Think about this. Since Donald Trump was elected and inaugurated, by any classical measurement of external or domestic issues, it's been a very tranquil time. Has it felt tranquil? No.
No.
What is the central cause of the turmoil? The president. He's the turbulent machine in what are ordinarily placid times.
Right.
And he loves that. As I quote Corey Lewandowski, Trump's first campaign manager in my book, Trump hates negative press unless he generates it.
That's amazing. You know, again, Major Garrett's new book, Mr. Trump's Wild Ride, The Thrills, Chills, Screams, and Occasional Blackouts of an Extraordinary Presidency. Blackouts. What are you talking about there?
I was at a book event not too many days ago in the midst of the Kavanaugh confirmation saga cliffhanger, and someone said, "Well, come on, what blackouts, really?"
Yeah,
I said, I wrote that a year and a half ago. I mean, you write a subtitle of a book well in advance of the actual book itself, and I just tried to create adjectives there that were value neutral, that are consistent with what you might experience on a thrill ride.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I explain it in the book is, well, the wild ride is a metaphor.
It's not
and
a thrill ride for a lot of people, Major.
It's right. It creates it. And so you can look at those adjectives. They're value neutral, but to each and every individual, they can mean something positive or negative.
That's right.
I wanted to be right in the middle of that continuum and let people decide for themselves whether that thrill or scream is negative, whether that blackout is like relief or just momentary loss of consciousness. But on a ride, you have ups and downs and twists and turns. And as I say in the book, this ride is being constructed as we are riding it. Trump doesn't know where it's going in every respect or in most respects. Neither do the Republicans who are riding along with him. Neither does the general public. And the whole point of the book is to sort of deal with this question that I think is legitimately asked. For God's sake, do we need another Trump book? I mean, seriously, haven't we had enough?
Right.
And I would say we need one more. Mine. Why? Because a lot has happened in the first year and a half of the Trump presidency that's going to be with this country whether you like it or hate it for 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, maybe 20 years. Things like that have already happened. Legacy-like items. And with Trump, so much of it is about the grabby headlines and the anxiety or the thrills, the chills, whatever. And I wanted to write a book about the actual substance, explain why it happened, why it's most likely to be with us for good or for ill, and explain those dimensions of this presidency. Not so much the backroom screaming and the vendettas and the rivalries. There's some of that in there, but mostly it's about what happened and why, not what didn't happen.
Yeah. You know, you've mentioned you covered President Obama's White House, a portion of President George W. Bush's White House. This White House is different. How is it different from what you've experienced?
Well, there's fewer people.
Mm-hmm.
By a great percentage.
People working in the
White House. Who work in the White House because the White House won't let them in, because if they had a social media post that was vaguely critical of Trump, they don't even get an interview. And some who don't even fall into that category but won't come in because of either reputational risk or they just can't stand and can't abide Trump. Some people, as I write in the book, especially in some detail in the epilogue, had worked for him, want him to succeed, but couldn't bear it. Just it was too taxing. It was too relentless for them, either personally or professionally or some combination of the both. So that's another component that's very different. One thing that's also different about the internal workings of the White House is, and this is somewhat consistent with what came up in the op-ed in the New York Times, what's the higher duty? Is it to serve the president and only the president? Is it to serve the Constitution? Is it to serve the verdict of the American electorate and say, this is not my kind of president. He doesn't do the things the way I would like to do them. He treats me sometimes harshly. And I have to deal with that psychologically. But what is the higher calling? That's a heavy existential question. You and I have been around politics for a long time. politics occasionally lends itself to an occasional existential question, but not usually. It's like, I'm with my guy, I'm with my gal, we're going to get that person elected, and I'm going to get a job, and I'm in harness. That's
right.
it.
Right.
Very dedicated, very devoted. Nothing wrong with that. This, there's like a constant struggle. What am I devoted to? Who am I working for? What am I trying to achieve? And if the president pops off or yells something, what do I do? Do I just smile and sort of tuck it in my back pocket, walk down the hall and say, we'll only talk about this again if you remember it, sir?
Yeah.
There's some of that that goes on.
What's your theory as to who wrote the New York Times op-ed?
I have a couple of theories on the who. More importantly, I think it's a who backed by a small committee. Two or three others.
That's been suggested.
Who wanted to get that idea, that notion across. And I talk in the book at one point, I have a whole chapter devoted to North Korea. And I mentioned that when the president was in Seoul, South Korea, there were a lot of omens around the Mueller investigation, political things happening, and his own agenda that looked like the whole enterprise was going to collapse in on itself. It just looked like it was about to fall apart. And 6 weeks later, he got the tax bill and his presidency was revived.
Mm-hmm.
I say in the book, this is not an uncommon cycle covering this president. There are all sorts of external and internal events that you look at and say, how can they keep things together? And yet, oddly, sometimes in spite of themselves, they sort of do keep things together at a certain level. And you can look at the recently negotiated trade deal between Canada and Mexico. That went ups and down. Was Canada going to be in, going to be out? Who knows? Is it as revolutionary as Trump says? No, but it is different. He said he would rewrite it. He did. And here's the thing about Trump that you have to understand. Because he is an expert at branding and celebrity, he picks fights in which he is very confident that at the end of calling the fight over, only he can define what victory is.
Hmm.
And that gives him an upper hand over everyone else.
For example?
Well, trade is an actual example. He said, I won on NAFTA. It's not even NAFTA anymore. It's renamed. It's the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. So he's rebranded it. Some of it comes from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. They admit that at the White House. Some of it's an outgrowth of the original NAFTA. They admit that, too. Were some things changed? Yes. Significantly? I'll leave that up to the trade experts. But it's not as if this is some colossal, completely different dynamic. But because Trump changed the conversation on trade, got in the face of our allies, made this a huge priority, got them to the table, the Canadians, when they didn't want to be and said they wouldn't be, got the 11th-hour deal, he can define victory on his terms.
That's interesting. Yeah.
And he knows that, and he craves those moments where he can say, I won, and it's victory on my terms, and all you others have to take it, because I said so.
CBS News Chief White House Correspondent Major Garrett is my guest. You write this about the president in the book, Major. I'm quoting here. Based on my own experience, I have come to believe that with Trump, every encounter is about demonstrating power and balancing power as the dynamic shifts, reclaiming it if Trump has momentarily lost some or unexpectedly parceling out a small sum as a kingly gift to a pauper.
Yes.
Explain that to me.
So everything, I believe, with President Trump is at one level or another transactional. Look at our foreign policy. America first, you be China first, you be Russia first, you be first, we'll be first, and everything's a transaction. There are no higher values. There are no higher aims. You do your stuff. We'll do our stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Where our interests intersect, we'll cut a deal. When they don't, we're going to leave each other alone. And if we have to bump into each other, well, we'll bump into each other, and I'll have the biggest military, and you're not going to like that. I mean, I've just summarized the Trump foreign policy, right? Very transactional. Interpersonally, that's always the case I've experienced with him. Everything is a test. Every encounter is a test, and you have never fully won the president's either authority. He does never confer the same amount of authority all the time, meaning you have to re-earn it. You have to re-earn his praise. You have to re-earn his attention every single time.
And you say never back down from him.
Right.
You back down, you lose.
You back down, you lose. And that crosses genders. It crosses parties. It crosses everyone.
Tell us about one time he had lit you up on Twitter.
Yes.
And then you bumped into
By Trumpian standards, somewhat mildly, but he lit me up. Yeah.
Yeah. You talked to him face-to-face following a GOP debate right after that. Describe that back and forth with him.
So he's coming down the line to the correspondents. We'd done this dance many times before. He walks along, you wave your arms frantically, he comes over to the camera and does the interview. He comes up to me and he looks like he's going to walk right past me. And let me just tell you, and I say in the book, look, if you're a network news correspondent and you're covering Trump and he walks by you, that's a failure.
Yeah.
That is an inexcusable day. You cannot have that day. You've got to get the interview. You've got to get the soundbite. So he's like walking. He said, I'm not talking to you. You're terrible. And I just looked at him. I said, you don't believe that. And he said, no, I do. I said, you don't believe that. He goes, no, I really do. You're terrible. You're awful. And I'm like, you don't believe that. And he did it one more time. And then finally I said, all right, what do you got? I'm paraphrasing. But the point was, I had to keep looking him in the eye and saying, whatever you're saying to me, you don't believe. You know it, and now I know it, and I'm letting you know I know it.
You had to stand up to the president of the United States.
He was a candidate at the time,
at
right.
that point, but the GOP frontrunner, you're standing up to him.
Now, I don't want to overhype it. It wasn't like super, you know, snarly. It wasn't snarly at all. It was very, very mellow. Mm-hmm. If you watch the tape, it's very mellow, but it's a test. And I think with Trump, based on lots of talks with people who work very close to him, everything is a test. Every single encounter is a test.
There's another moment with him I want you to describe. August 2015, Birch Run, Michigan, long before he's won the GOP nomination. You talked to him following a rally, and you challenged him on his poll numbers. Tell us about that exchange and what that said to you about Donald Trump.
So this rally was a big crowd, Birch Run, Michigan, one of the first rallies for the Trump campaign. It wasn't even a Trump rally itself. They didn't even have campaign buttons or stickers or press passes. It was a fundraiser for the two counties in Michigan, in which the two closest counties to Birch Run, Michigan. I think Genesee County was one. I forget the name of the other. And so you pay $25 to get a regular seat, $75 to get a front row seat. Big crowd. Trump thinks it's amazing. He's so happy with it. Comes out, and this is just after the first Republican debate, the one in Cleveland. And I said, you know, some polling data in two states, Iowa and South Carolina, and also New Hampshire, suggested some people were put off by you.
After the debate.
The debate. He said, no, I won. I said, well, I'm just telling you these poll numbers. He said, no, I won. Look at all the internet polls, which he always cited. I won. I said, well, I'm just talking about this actual data. He says, excuse me, did I win the debate or not? And I said, that's for you to decide. And he said, if you don't say I won, you're not an honest reporter. Bye-bye. Stalks away from me.
Wow.
And I'm like, huh, okay, well, that's Trump. He goes into his SUV, which is about 20 feet away from me, gets in. On the passenger side, the driver's looking at me kind of warily, like, that didn't look like that went well. Trump may be angry. What's going on?
Trump rolls the window down.
Trump tells his driver, roll the window down. Then he beckons me over, and I start to walk over to his SUV to where the driver's window is open. Through that space, he says, you see what I just did there, right? You saw what I did. Call me in New York. We'll get together. We'll have lunch.
Uh-huh.
I'm like, yeah, I did see what you did there. You're just putting me on, testing me out. Jerking me around.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of politicians have jerked you around. Lots of politicians have jerked me around. But there's a very specific, personal, and intense way that Trump does it. And as I end that chapter, we never had lunch.
I was going to say, do you ever have lunch?
Or anywhere else.
Yeah. You know, something a lot of Democrats puzzle about is this president's ability to continue to command the national spotlight. You write, he's a master of this new age media world, the same way Ronald Reagan was a master of a more traditional, classical, if you will, media world back in the 1980s. What makes him so good at it?
Because I believe he has, for lots of different reasons, some of them accidental, meaning accidentally, historically, he had this skill set that found its expression in social media, and the two melded together, not because anyone was a genius to think of it, but just because they do. Trump is who he is. Social media is what it is. And they meld together in ways that he has found exploitive and positively exploitive to the absolute utter frustration of every political opponent, Republican or Democrat.
Yeah.
During the 2015 and 16 cycle leading up to the Republican nominating process and going through it, lots of skilled and accomplished Republican politicians with real resumes and fundraisers behind them and constituencies would have elaborate campaign plans obliterated by 8:15 every morning because Trump had three tweets and one phoner with a network.
Right.
And their day was gone.
Yeah.
Nothing that they wanted to talk about had any relevance anymore. Why? Because Trump said four things. And they could never break through. And it drove them literally to distraction. The same thing could be said for Hillary Clinton. Because there were days when, look at all the terrible press that Trump's getting. All he cares about is, I'm dominating.
Mm-hmm.
I'll ride out the heat. I'll ride out the hot press. I'll ride out the negativity. What I know is I'm the center of the conversation. And for the people who want me to be strong, and for the people who think strength is their asset and their ally, as I describe it in the book, their lottery ticket, politically, me being the center of attention tells them I'm on their side. and they can stick with me. That was his theory. Did I have doubts about that theory also of the campaign? Absolutely, because it's something I'd never seen before. I described Trump at one point in the book as part of a new school of rock, like the movie School of Rock.
Mm-hmm.
Jack Black. And I said I was one of those fussy parents because I was seeing something new and unconventional in politics.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't come around. I'm not pro or con. I'm just trying to evaluate it with a bit more wisdom than I did initially.
I got 45 seconds.
Okay.
How do you see and rate his reelection prospects as of today, Major?
Well, Republicans are feeling energized for the midterms. I write in the book in the epilogue, if Republicans hold the House and hold the Senate, his renomination is guaranteed and his likelihood to be reelected far more pronounced than it was on Inauguration Day. If Democrats sweep, everything is up for grabs.
Okay, that's Major Garrett. He's the chief White House correspondent for CBS News. His new book, Mr. Trump's Wild Ride, The Thrills, Chills, Screams, and Occasional Blackouts of an Extraordinary Presidency. Major, what a pleasure to have you. Thanks for taking some time.
Thank you for the time. I appreciate it very much.
Coming up, we all have friends who seem to excel at everything they put their minds to. That's the case for Vijay Iyer, pianist, composer, writer, Grammy nominee, Harvard professor, MacArthur Genius Grant winner. The list goes on. He's up next, so stay with us. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Vijay Iyer is a musician who may not be as well known as some others in the business, but few are as accomplished. He's a pianist, a composer, a writer, Grammy nominee, a MacArthur Genius Grant winner, and at Harvard, he's the, get this, the Franklin D. and Florence Rosenblatt Professor of Arts and Graduate Advisor in Creative Practice and Critical Inquiry. He's something else, too, Downbeat Magazine's Jazz Artist of the Year. He'll be here on Sunday night at Starlight Theater as part of Kansas City's Open Spaces Festival. This is what a Jazz Artist of the Year sounds like. This is Vijay Iyer from his 2012 album, Accelerando. This is Actions Speak. Jay Iyer, welcome to Up to Date. So nice to have you today.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. And I'm wondering, you know, when you're the jazz, a Downbeat Jazz Artist of the Year and a Genius Grant winner and an endowed professor of the arts at Harvard, how much pressure are you under every time you put out an album or walk out onto the stage?
I make music for people. Mm-hmm. Not for institutions.
Uh-huh.
And I take nothing for granted when I come out on stage. I usually assume that hardly anyone in the room has heard of me or heard any of my music. And that seems to be the best way to approach it, is sort of start fresh every time and really try to care about everyone in the room.
You know,
that's the best way to approach it.
When creativity is so central to what you're about, how do you manage to renew yourself so that you can do the work you want to do with a schedule like the one you have?
Well, I'm fortunate to have a lot of really incredible collaborators, and we kind of get by with help from one another. Mm-hmm. I'd say, and the music that we make is inherently collaborative, sort of from the ground up. you know, I was actually enjoying listening to what you just played me because it's from several years ago.
Yes,
and
it is.
Kind of brings me back to what life felt like back then in the optimistic years of 2011 when we recorded that. And,
when so, you say your music is your music is collaborative, Vijay, from the ground up, what do you mean?
For example, just hearing what was happening and what you just played, the points of contact between myself and the drummer, Marcus Gilmore, on that mm-hmm. record, and the bassist, Stefan Crump, both of whom I've been working with for many years.
Many years.
You know, in Marcus's case, since he was a kid. And so I guess I feel those bonds, you know, being sounded in the way that we play together in time, the way we are able to synchronize and be expressive with the material, and especially because a lot of almost all of what we do has an improvisational element in it, which means that it's all born of listening and responding, and it's so much is about what you bring to the table in the moment, you know. So that has to be that has to come from somewhere, and we have to really be flexible and open to the energy in the room and to the people around us and the people we're with. So those relationships that last years, they really speak through those through the sounds we make.
Vijay Iyer is my guest. He's Downbeat Magazine's Jazz Artist of the Year. He'll be playing in Kansas City Sunday night at 9 at Starlight Theater. More on that in just a little bit. You know, I was struck by, in reading about you and what you just said, that in the classes you teach at Harvard, your students aren't just playing instruments. They do a lot of reading. They do a lot of writing. Is that all about getting them connected with the larger world, which is something that you talk about a lot?
Well, sure. You know, music isn't just about making pretty sounds to make people feel good. I mean, it's a lot about that, but it's also about, you know, it has to reflect the time you're in, the moment you're in, and the energy of this, you know, that particular historical time period. And, you know, I think artists have a responsibility to, you know, on the one hand, give people a certain kind of solace from the world, but also, on the other hand, to give them a sense of catharsis, maybe, to mm-hmm. feel that maybe we get to bear what others can't bear, you know, that we get to kind of be the vessel or the channel for some of those energies, you know. I mean, I think a lot of people are carrying frustration in their bodies right now,
yeah.
You know, just because I see that our political climate as like a public health crisis, because I mean, everyone's just kind of hunched over their phones all the time, sweating, and blood pressure is high, and
yeah,
you know, we kind of have to deal with that. We deal with, I mean, that's the thing, is that it's not abstract, it's actually, it's in the room with us, like mm-hmm. it's in people's bodies in a very real way. And if we can bring them to the point where they're actually breathing together and motivated together, then we've accomplished something. But we mm-hmm. can't do that without taking all of that into account. I guess that's what I mean
right.
by it.
You know, you work so closely with students, and yet you once said that music conservatories around the country are a bit removed from the context in which music exists. You said this, and if you don't have contact with a larger world, then you lose track of what you're doing. How do you overcome that? How do you get your students out into the world besides just reading and writing?
Well, you know, being at Harvard means that it's not a conservatory. It's not a school of music. It's actually, music might be one of a dozen things that any given student is doing. And even if they're a music major, which some of them are, but a lot of them are not, you know, because many of them are sort of hedging their bets and thinking like, well, I'll take music courses now, but maybe I really want to be a doctor or
right.
something, or a,
right.
or go into finance. So sometimes I, help them figure out if that's really what they want. But for the most part, you know, I find that they have to find a role for music in their lives themselves, and they have to also kind of come to grips with where it came from in the first place. I mean, we're associated with this music that's called jazz, which is itself the music of African Americans who came from, you know, who were in the 20th century, were in, and by and large currently as well, we're in, you know, especially in American cities, we're in this position of extreme dispossession. Mm-hmm. And so this music was born of that circumstance, you know, and if you can't come to grips with that reality, with that history, then you're doing something else.
Yeah.
So it's sort of about how you find your, how you place yourself in this stream of history that we're stepping into. And that's kind of something that I am always mindful of myself. I mean, I'm not African American. My parents are from India.
I was going to say, you're a South Asian American. So how do you connect with the history of African American music?
Well, we could, I mean, any American has to ask themselves that. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, when Jimmy Fallon and his, and like Ellen DeGeneres lip sync to Migos or something like that, you know, you have to, you could ask them that too. Like, what is their actual, you know, it's being done for comic relief, but is it, what's their angle here? Like, what's the relationship there? What is the history that's being conjured or addressed, or are they ignoring it and just sort of making fun of it or mm-hmm. making light of it? So I think about that all the time in terms of my own position. You know, I'm a person of color, but I'm not black. And I, that, you know, so that puts me in this peculiar middle ground that's uneasy, you know, in the sense that, well, basically I have to win people's trust, and mm-hmm. I take that very seriously. You know, I collaborate with a lot of other artists of color, and especially a lot of African-American artists. And we take that business very seriously. You know, what is the message that we're sending just mm-hmm. by being on stage together? And that's, you know, that's very much a part of what the music does. It kind of show it, in a way it demonstrates that these unities are possible, even though they're not currently right. present in our day-to-day lives.
Vijay Iyer is my guest. He's playing at 9 Sunday night at Starlight Theater as part of the Open Spaces Festival, which is wrapping up this weekend. Let's listen to some more from Vijay Iyer. This is Down to the Wire from his latest album with his sextet. The album is Far From Over. That's Vijay Iyer from the album Far From Over. You know, you've said that you often have to disabuse your students of a lot of things, including a lot of assumptions about what jazz is and whether it is what they think it is. I mean, what assumptions do they have about jazz that you have to disabuse them of?
Well, partly gets back to what I was just saying about the history of the music mm-hmm. and where it came from and whom it came from. You know, I think it's better to think of it not as a style so much as a history of ideas and a history of a community, you know? Mm-hmm. And so then again, like I said, you have to kind of cultivate your relationship or come up with a sense of what your relationship is to that history and to those communities, and particularly the African-American communities. I mean, Kansas City is such an incredible music city, and yes. especially it was a center. It was like a, you know, Charlie Parker and Jay McShann and all these people, right. you know, who kind of came through there. And it's such a historically important place. And, you know, I think people think of it, a lot of students today think of it as a style that's sort of abstract. It's just sort of like you follow some rules, you play the certain notes in a certain way at the right time, and you play this scale to go with this chord, and then you're playing jazz. And it's like, well, I think, you know, I think of this often of this quote from Abby Lincoln, the great singer, mm-hmm. who I had the opportunity to see her live many times. And one time I was in this kind of seminar setting where she spoke to a bunch of us. And one of the things she said in that room was, you know, a lot of people today think they're playing jazz, but they're not really, because jazz does not exist. Which was like a sort of shocking thing for me to hear.
Uh-huh.
But then I had to kind of come to terms with that, that there are icons in this music who reject the term, you know? And that actually, if you follow the history all the way back 100 years worth, there were always people who rejected the term. Duke Ellington, mm-hmm. Miles Davis,
right.
Charles Mingus, you know, up to the present day, Steve Coleman, Henry Threadgill. You know, and what the other thing that Abby said in that moment, she said that, you know, a lot of people think Bird, meaning Charlie Parker, was playing jazz, but he was just playing his spirit. So yeah, then to think of it actually as this spiritual practice and as a community force and as something much larger than a style that you can play right or wrong, you know, and also to think of it as a contested term and one that we might push back on, mm-hmm. as that's something that, you know, it's hard for students, let alone, you know, audiences, to right. come by information like that.
You know, you're such an interesting guy because you're talking so philosophically here this morning, and yet you were a physics and math major as an undergrad at Yale, and your PhD thesis at the University of California, Berkeley, was titled Microstructures of Feel, Macrostructures of Sound, Embodied Cognition in West African and African American Musics. You know, I sort of get the connection between music and jazz. I'm awful at both, and then with math, but how direct of a line is there between music and math?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, you know, you can use math to describe anything. Another way to put it is, anytime you make anything, whether it's a birthday cake or a martini or a doorway or, you know, a sandcastle, you're dealing with some kind of proportions. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you have to measure them precisely in order to make it work right. Like, you want the door to fit into the doorway mm-hmm. and not jam, and it has to be the right shape. It also has to let people through it, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, so that you could say that involves math, but that's kind of a banal thing to say about it. So I think that's true with music too. It's like, yeah, I mean, for example, the piece you just played was, you could notate it in 11/16, but who cares actually, mm-hmm. besides the people who are playing it, that doesn't matter, because it's actually about a trying to get to a certain feeling, a certain way of moving together, you know? So it's about the feeling of that that matters. It's the way of moving, the quality of movement that really matters. And you can slice it any way you want arithmetically, but that isn't what music does, you know? And so I guess I try to keep all that in perspective, because people are often quick to try to tag me as mathematical, but it doesn't right. really, I don't know, it doesn't get to the heart of what we do whatsoever. I mean, the other thing about it, which I often have to kind of remind people, is that, you know, Coltrane's music was mathematical too. Mm-hmm. And actually, so was Charlie Parker's music. You know, like we could, not only could we describe it mathematically, but those artists were aware of structure in a very profound way, and they could describe it theoretically using some quantitative terms and qualitative terms that are pretty precise, you know. So they were also, if I'm a mathematician, then so were they, and if they aren't, then neither am I. I guess I'd put
yeah,
it that way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm just wondering how you balance your life, Vijay. I mean, you and your wife live in Harlem. You've got a daughter. You teach in Boston. You've got your students. You've got your concerts. You've, you know, but you're also, you got your recording dates. It sounds like a whole lot to me. How do you manage it?
Well, what I've been trying to do lately is find silence, just find moments where I can just sit in a dark room.
Yeah.
Which is like, that's the way they treat people who have concussions. I guess maybe sometimes it feels like I'm banging my head against a wall. But it is actually really important for all of us, especially in such a noisy time, to find some silence for ourselves. It's I think it's what they call self-care. But it's also mm-hmm. about how do you find the resources within yourself to continue
right.
on any given day. And that's and I often tell my students that to try to, you know, to make space in their lives, you know, because especially at Harvard, they love to the way they got into Harvard is by stacking their schedules, of course, and being like great at a bunch of things and doing all these extracurriculars and so forth. And you know, once you are in that, you don't have to do that.
Right, like right, right.
In fact, you know, you never really have to do that. It's kind of, I mean, it's nice to sort of have a lot of interest and cultivate them, but it's also nice to take your time, you know, and find time in your lives to breathe and to meditate and reflect on what you might do next.
That's Vijay Iyer. He'll be performing on Sunday evening at 9. Preceding him on stage will be the Herman Mahari Quartet. I love both of these guys. It's all part of Open Spaces 2018. This is not the final weekend coming up, but again, Vijay Iyer will be taking part in day 3 of the weekend festival, 9 o'clock Sunday night. Hey, what a pleasure to have you. Thanks for taking the time, Vijay. We'll look forward to seeing you in town here.
Hey, thank you. I'm looking forward to my visit. See you soon.
You bet. Tomorrow, meet the new chancellor of UMKC, who's meeting the challenges of higher education head-on. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Emily Reed. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.